I should have been here next year when the Aussies are playing cricket. Anyhow, so I'll have to have an excuse to come over next year as well. At the same time as a few test matches. Rightio. So what a lovely. I can see everybody now. Probably a few people I know there somewhere. So anyhow, we've been involved for over a week now. I arrived with my youngest daughter, Abigail, on Friday a week ago. And it's been nonstop. It's like being a submarine. We've been underwater and come up every now and again for a bit of fresh air. The subject matter that I'm over here primarily to speak about is not an easy subject matter. It's about the Holocaust. And as you are all aware, because you're interested in the Jewish people, anything to do with the Holocaust is a very, very dark and terrible episode to study. But some years ago, I was asked or approached by David Pileggi from Christchurch in Jerusalem with a vision he had been carrying for a number of years, and he'd been dropping some hints to me through those years. And I had other things on my agenda at the time, and I didn't take up the hint. And what was on his heart was to actually research and find out what was happening to the Jewish followers of Jesus, known then as Hebrew Christians or Jewish Christians, today Messianic Jews, but they didn't use that term back then. What happened to them during the Holocaust? We tend to concentrate upon the 6 million Jewish people who died, and not to give too much consideration to what happened to the Jewish people who were involved in the church during that period. And it could be that many people don't give consideration to it because they would have thought, well, they're in the church. They probably were, they were okay. They survived. Well, in actual fact, that's not really the case. In most instances, the Jewish followers of Jesus suffered exactly the same as all the other Jewish people. Only with a few exceptions were they able to actually survive. There were individual survivors, of course, as there were individual Jewish people who survived throughout Europe. But collectively, it was only primarily in the Netherlands, actually, that a large portion of people, Jewish people, were able to survive because they were involved in the church. So in, I think it was about March or April of 2018, David again asked me to consider doing this research study. And on that occasion, I just sensed that it was the right time. When you do research, you actually have to be willing to, in a sense, step into the subject matter. When I was living in Israel and I was researching initially from 1986, I've been living in Israel 5 years previously, but 1986, I began to work with CMJ as the guide at Christchurch. And so, I'm not British and I'm not Anglican. I got sympathy for things British and whatever else, but nevertheless, I wasn't. So I actually had to then sort of step into that world in order to be able to comprehend the history. Into 19th century Jerusalem. I was living in 20th century Jerusalem, but had to step back into 19th century Jerusalem to try to comprehend the historical facts that I was studying. I had to sort of try to comprehend how they fitted together and the development of the history. And that also meant coming over to the UK on many occasions to do the research, go to the archives and just become familiar as much as I possibly could with the subject matter. And then I began to delve into the whole geopolitical and military component of Israel and the role of the British in that region, the Australian and New Zealand soldiers, the Anzacs, and they had to go out and try to find locations which were synonymous to that history. So in a sense, you have to step in to the subject matter to the best of your ability to get a better comprehension of what you see written in the books and the documents and the archives. Otherwise, it's just black ink on white paper. You've got to get a bit more of a feel. But when you come to the Holocaust, well, you've got to sort of, in a sense, count the cost. Because for all the years that I've been involved with Jewish people, I first got interested in the Holocaust as a young boy in the West Australian bush when I was reading about it in war books. And about the age of 11 or 12, I purchased a book on Treblinka, which is one of the death camps. And you'd read about it and hear about it. In Israel, I worked amongst Holocaust survivors and we had Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Day, every year. So you're familiar with the Holocaust, but that's different to actually then beginning to research it because you've got to take that step into the subject matter. And it's not a subject matter that anybody would want to, in a sense, to step into because it's very deep. And from the very outset, I could see that what Jeremiah wrote in chapter 17, verse 9 was completely correct. The heart is evil above all things and desperately wicked. Who can understand it? And that's a summation of the Holocaust. It's just so dark and it's just full of wickedness and evil. But it came from the hearts of men, okay? Men and women perpetrated the Holocaust. Well, they were the ones that were actually firing the guns and putting the gas in there, okay? It wasn't anything else, okay? It was human beings who were doing it. So from the outset, when I began to step into it, I realized, well, I've got to go and visit the locations that are synonymous to the subject matter. It's not a matter of just going and trying to find details about Jewish followers of Jesus. You also got to try to comprehend the bigger picture. So in 2018, not long after I began the project, the study project, I came across to Israel to do some research and then went to Poland for a Holocaust tour with David Pelegi and visited a few other places as well and visited four of the five death camps. There were five death camps in the Holocaust. There was Auschwitz, which had been previously a Polish army barracks, and there's Chełmno, which was a mansion, and Jewish people were taken to the mansion and from there put into vans and taken to a forest. By that stage, they had been gassed to death. And then there were three custom-made death camps called Treblinka, Chełmno, and Belzec. Well, on that visit, we visited four of those death camps, as well as lots of concentration camps, and so on and so forth. A little spider just coming down out of the ceiling. Yeah, he's a dead spider now. And so those were the camps we went to, but there were other things as well. There were the ghettos, and there were locations, lots of locations in the forest where Jewish people were taken to. Pits were dug and they were shot, and that was in Poland itself. But the vast majority of that method of killing took place in Belarus in Ukraine, where in excess of 1.5 million Jewish people were actually shot. This is before the gas chambers began to be operating. So you've got to see these things. You've got to say, wow, this is real. This is true. Even though I'd have visited some camps previously, when you're doing the research study, then suddenly what you've been reading about is it's there, it's on the ground. And it's quite daunting. But when you start studying a project like this about trying to find the identities of Jewish followers of Jesus, well, it's really like trying to find the proverbial needle in the haystack. And it's a small needle in a big haystack. Because oftentimes when you read through the sources, it talks about converts. And that's basically it. Or if you're reading a Hebrew-speaking document, it's Meshumadim, which is the word for traitors, okay? And it's sort of denigrated a little bit, put to the side a little bit. But, hey, listen, each and every one of those people was a person or a real-life person. So to find details about those real-life people was not so easy at all. There are documents. There are documents written by some survivors, for instance. I mean, early on when I started to do the research study back in Western Australia in my office, I realized, oh, I do have a book or two or a pamphlet about that. And I forgot about it. It was just stuck away until the right time. And I had one written by a survivor called Rachmiel Friedland in Poland, for instance. And it wasn't a huge book. It was his own testimony written not so long after he survived and he later went to the United States. But he gave lots of information in there about other people who were involved in different churches in Warsaw particularly who didn't survive. And so suddenly you say, well, there are names here. And those names are people and they have a story. And so then you begin to build the picture and then you read something else and you see a name. Not much information. Well, that bit of information actually then comes over here and you can put it together with what, say, Rachmiel Friedland wrote. And you begin to build up a picture. But those books were quite rare. And so you had to go to the archives and dig into the archives. So my second trip at the end of 2018, I think I spent 6 weeks or so. I was in the UK, Canada, and the United States on that occasion, going to as many different archives as I possibly could get to. From organizations that actually had been operating in Europe prior to the war, to a degree during the war, but mostly prior to the war. They had to stop when the war began. And to try to get into the primary materials as much as possible. Now, quite a bit of information did come forth from those archives, but sometimes when They refer to people that just have the first name. There's no surname. Okay, so there's nothing you can really go on with. But again, you put information together and you start to build up a picture. Now, I just give you one particular occasion when I really believe the Lord was leading and helping and guiding during that period of time. I'd already heard about a man called Jacob Yotch. Jacob Yotch had been the pastor for a Hebrew Christian community congregation in Warsaw, a very large and dynamic one. And that was operated by CMJ. Now, I wasn't looking just at CMJ, of course. It was all the different entities and organizations and churches that were involved. It's not just a CMJ-related project. But this was a congregation, and I had a certain amount of material because I'd read about him in the past, and so because I worked for CMJ for 20 years. And then I knew that he had he survived. Jacob Yotch, the pastor of this congregation in Warsaw, he had survived because he's over here in England at the time when the war broke out in Poland. He couldn't get back. Okay, he had full intentions of going back, but he couldn't get back. So he survived. But his family back in Poland had to go through it all. And his father was shot, was found out by the Nazis. He'd been hiding for 2.5 years in a woodshed. And his mother actually had been passed herself over as a Polish lady, and because she spoke perfect Polish, and she was able to take care of the husband. It was being hidden in a woodshed of a Gentile Christian, not that far away. But unfortunately, the Nazis found out about him. Basil Yotch was his name, and Anna survived, but she was badly beaten up. And so after the war, she managed to get out with another son, Paul. And she got to England and spent some time with her son that was in England by that stage, Jakob Yotch. And then later they went to Canada. He went to do a teaching position in Canada. And while he was there, he heard that the German government was offering compensation to Jewish people who had survived the Holocaust. And so he made an application. But of course, then the German authorities had to research this. They just couldn't take anybody's word for it. They had to sort of find out if what he was saying was true. So they had a lawyer and then a researcher on the case. And so too did Jacob Yotch over in Canada have a lawyer. And so lots of information going forth. Now, in the midst of doing the research, and I was going to go to Canada, to Toronto, where Jacob Yotch actually had been, there was an archive with a lot of his stuff, but he also had a surviving son, Phil Yotch, and so I made contact with him. I met him once before, many years before, and he lives in Toronto, so I went to be with him, and he had material relating to his father, but also to his grandparents, and then he said something like this. He said, yes, my sister and I were going through some stuff the other day, and we found a box we didn't even know we had, and it's got material in it relating to that period of time. So, wow, you'd like to hear that when you're doing research. So we began to go through this material. And then at one stage, he comes out with a file. I don't know, it might have been that thick. You know, if I tell the story too often, it goes like that. But it's probably a file about that thick. And it was full of the correspondence between Jacob Jotch's lawyer and the people back in Germany. Letters go to and fro for a number of years. Plus the material that this researcher had found when he went to verify the story. If Jacob Yotch's mother, Anna, had actually survived and the story she told, if it was true, and so on and so forth. So there's all that material. So it's all in German and a bit of other languages. Now, I don't know German. I know words and I can read dates, okay? And so I began to go through it. I could see these consistent dates. And I thought, well, that must be the day that Basil Yotch was shot, was found, and the day later he was shot, because he kept finding this date. And other very, very relevant information. Now, that's an extremely valuable source, which will be helpful to me to put together about what happened to this family and what they had to endure. So as a result of that, with the collation of other materials, I could put together a bit of a narrative about what happened to the Jewish followers of Jesus, Jewish Christians in Poland, through this family, because there were three generations of them. Who followed Jesus in Warsaw. They lived in Warsaw, but also in the city of, it'll come back to me soon. Okay, it's a big city in the western part of Ukraine. Lviv. And so you could actually, in a sense, tell the bigger picture of what was happening in Poland through one particular family. And it gives people a chance, readers a chance of actually looking at the personal side of it. Because when you do something with the Holocaust, you see big figures. Now, I was reading figures of 10,000 Jewish people being shot in a forest, or being 34,000 being shot in Kiev, for instance, a Babi Yar. And how can you commute that, basically? You got your figure of 6 million, and then you look at these individuals and details. But those 10,000 people that you see written, 10,000 were shot in a forest here and there or somewhere else on such and such a day by one death squad called an Einsatzgruppe. But every one of those figures is a person, okay, had a destiny. And so you've got to, in a sense, if you really want to bring this storyline over, I think you've got to do it from the personal side. Look at this particular family and the struggles they went through and realize, well, that's the story of one person, one family, then you replicate it. And that's the 6 million, or that's the tens of thousands of Jewish Christians, for instance. So that was a real a bonus to be able to do that. And I was in contact with Phil Yotch, the son, all the way through the process. And he also learned things about his own family that he didn't know, because we accessed the material from all over. And so that was the first publication on the subject matter. It's called Basley and Anna Yotch, Jewish Christian Victims of the Holocaust. But when I was doing the research in 2018, I spent some time with the Laurie family, with Esme and Tom Laurie in Reading, and because they had some archives there. Then I went to the United States, and then Esme contacted me, and she said, well, Kelvin, I've just had contact with somebody who is the son of Johannes Rottenberg, who knows where the son of Johannes Rottenberg lives. Now, Johannes Rottenberg was the, as Jay mentioned earlier on, about he was involved with the Elam community in the Netherlands that had started up in Rotterdam. But in 1939, they'd sold that property and they'd moved to The Hague and established the community called Elam in The Hague. And it was there, that building that was actually taken over by the Nazis in 1940. But they'd been operating from this particular place in Rotterdam called Elam for decades, because so many tens of thousands of Jewish people had gone from the Russian Empire through to this location in Rotterdam, then onto ships that took them to the New World. And so this ministry operated by CMJ initially, and then by Dutch Christians together, was ministering to all these Jewish people, these Jewish refugees. And so many of them came to this place and they said, well, listen, we've gone through so many terrible things in our lives, and we've come here and this is like an oasis. This is an Elam, Elam being an oasis, of course. And so the ministry is called Elam. And so Johannes Rottenberg had come to faith in Jesus as the Messiah in that very place in 1911. Then later he went to the United States. He trained up as a reform minister and then came back first of all to England from 24 to 29, worked in the East End of London with another ministry, not with CMJ, with another ministry that was operating here. And then he went to head up the work of Elam in 1929 in the Netherlands. And so he was a Dutch reform minister and was working amongst Jewish people, refugees also, Jewish refugees from Germany now, in the 1930s. So he's quite a well-known minister and person in the Netherlands. He had two sons who were both born in England, Isaac and David, and four daughters who had previously been born in the United States. And so this man was a very, very important person in this whole storyline of what happened to the Jewish followers of Jesus in the Netherlands. And he had the two sons. After the war, they survived and they went to the United States. One became a pastor and one had another regular position. So anyhow, to cut a long story short, I then found out through this contact from Esme Laurie that this one of the sons was still surviving and lived in San Diego. Well, I had to do some research over in California from two missionary societies who had been living in Poland. And it didn't take much then contact David. And of course, he was very willing to meet up with somebody who was writing the storyline of what happened in the Netherlands. And we had a great time together. And so he was actually there. He was an eyewitness of his own father, basically, at the time he was arrested by the Nazis. And he never saw his father again. He was taken away. I'll tell you more about what happened in a minute. And he himself, because he's half Jewish and he was eligible to send up, he sent to a labor camp, he had to go underwater, as it was called, underground, diving under, you know, get out of reach of the Nazis. So you know, he himself experienced stuff, but he also witnessed his own father, who was a minister, and he had materials to show me. So it's invaluable when you actually get that, you hear that yourself from somebody who had experienced it. So in time, I went back to Australia and had to begin to put all this material together. And again, it's not so easy putting a whole amount of material together. There's lots of it. And I began to be bogged down a little bit about the number or the amount of material. So I had to work out my own models, you might say, research models. And I began to realize there were seven groups of Jewish Christians. When you read the official sources, they just talk about converts, okay, and that's it. But there were seven groups within that broader context. Now, the official Nazi designation for the Jewish people who follow Jesus, who are in the church, is non-Aryan Christian, okay? So in Germany, you're either Aryan or you're non-Aryan. Aryan were all the Germans, Nordic, Caucasian, you name it, whatever. And who wasn't one of those was one of the others. So the Sinter, the Roma people, the Gypsies, and of course, the Jewish people. And the German ideal was to purify Germany, okay, make it completely Aryan, all the non-Aryans had to go. So a big problem for the Germans was, well, what about the Jews who are in the church? The church was regarded as a conduit of the Nazi worldview. They wanted to bring their worldview into German society through all the different institutions. Well, of course, one of the main institutions would be the church, because that most German people were baptized members of the churches. But they got a problem. They wanted to bring their worldview through the church, yet you've got Jewish people in the church, and that's an anomaly. That's a no-no. So they have to go. And so that's why they call them non-Aryan Christians, and there was no place in the church for them, and that caused a big struggle, challenge for the church in Germany between those who said, yep, we're going to live up to what the Nazi leadership says, we're going to get the Jewish people out, but other people like Bonhoeffer and Niemöller and others, many, many others, said, no, that's against the character of the true church, which is Jew and Gentile together. Okay, so you can see this conflict in the church. But nevertheless, overall, they're called non-Aryan Christians. So I began to see that there were sort of, in a sense, seven groups within that broader categorization. For instance, and this was the same in most of the rest of Europe as well. So you had the Jewish people who believed in Jesus as the Messiah before the war began, before the 1st of September 1939. So that would be one group of people, genuine followers of Jesus, were convicted in their own hearts that he was the Messiah. And the second would be those who, for socioeconomic reasons, converted and were baptized. Now, in Europe, many times, it may be the same in Britain as well, at certain stages of history, it may be that in order for a Jewish person to actually go up in society and get a particular job or position, they had to become part of the society, which meant being converted and being baptized and so on and so forth. Okay, I use those words lightly, because converted and baptized, because sometimes it wasn't always done for the right motives. But anyhow, so there's quite a few people in that category, and they may not have actually been true followers of Jesus, but they did it for socioeconomic reasons. Another group were those who were marrying Gentiles, and they would be converted and baptized. Okay, use those same terms, in order to be able to marry a Gentile or a Christian person. And a fourth group would be the children and the grandchildren of those first three groups. Because let's say if a Jewish person truly followed Jesus, truly believed in Jesus as the Messiah, there's no guarantee that their children and grandchildren would actually have the same faith commitment. They could have still gone to church or not gone to church. But they were cut off, in a sense, from the Jewish community. They were in the broader Gentile community now, and so they were quite assimilated. And there would have been quite a few people in that category as well. I mean, in my readings, I've discovered information about the Nazis coming to the door, knocking on the door, saying, you're coming with me. Why? Because you're Jewish. You're going to the ghetto. And the person had no idea they were Jewish, okay? Because such as they might have been their parents or their grandparents who had done such and such a thing. And so that's another group of people. And then you had those who during the war were baptized in order to be physically saved. And there were times when churches actually would endeavor to do that as well. But, you know, they would have some form of a catechism, and the catechism was sometimes shortened because of circumstances. Now, in those instances, some of those Jewish people may definitely have come to a conviction that, yeah, what I'm reading about is true, Jesus is the Messiah. But others might not have done it as well. And then a sixth category, are the children. And many Jewish children were given over by their parents to be taken care of by Gentile Christians, individuals or in institutions, monasteries and convents and so on and so forth. And for those children to be better protected, they would have actually, in some instances, been baptized in order to fit into the broader community. And at the end of the war, that was a very, very problematic system, because if the parents survived, they'd come back for the children. Many didn't survive, so the Jewish institutions would come looking for those children. And sometimes those children did not want to go back into the Jewish community. Sometimes the host did not want to release those children. So you can imagine that would be quite a contentious matter. And the last group is those Jewish people who actually came to faith in Jesus as the Messiah during the Holocaust, during the period of the Second World War. And we do have evidence that a number of these people did exist. In the Netherlands, for instance, quite a few, primarily younger people, became followers of Jesus. And at the end of the war, an organization was established called Haderech, the Way, in order to actually give a protection and a covering, what you might say, sustenance to these younger Jewish followers of Jesus. So now when I read through materials and I see the word non-Aryan Christian or convert or something, then I realize, well, I've got to read a bit more of the context to see where they actually fitted in. Now, in the Second World War, none of those categories would help a Jewish person, basically. Some circumstances, it was, you know, they managed to survive because they're in the church. But generally speaking, if you were Jewish, it doesn't matter if you're a communist Jewish person, an Orthodox Jewish person, a totally secular Jewish person, or a Jewish person who was in the church, it didn't matter. You were non-Aryan. Okay, you were non-Aryan Christian. You're Jewish. Your bloodline says you're Jewish. And so therefore, you also would fit into that broader picture of all the Jewish people being murdered. Now, that's one particular model that has helped me tremendously. And of course, if you want to know more details, we've put together since then also another publication called Jewish Christians in the Netherlands during the Holocaust, as well as the one in Poland. And we've tried to put this in print. And the second thing which helped me tremendously was to understand different phases of the Holocaust. Because you're reading through a lot of material and you see something happen, and that happened because of a decision. And then you see something else, and that happened because of another decision. And you say, hang on, this doesn't tally up. And I'll give you an example. One particular time, I was reading about Jewish people in the western part of Germany who have been transported from the western part of Germany to the southern part of France. Now, I first heard about this by reading through a testimony of a survivor who, and it wasn't a survivor, but was actually writing about her, but she had a diary, and that person got hold of the diary, so she wasn't a survivor. And she was a non-Aryan Christian, and it was her life story, basically, up until the point when she was taken to, I think it was Auschwitz. Now, this Jewish person was in the western part of Germany, and she was sent down to the southern part of France. Now, when you read that, you think, hang on, the train driver got his directions wrong. He went the wrong way. He should have gone to Poland and not to the southern part of France. But no, southern part of France, to a little place called Gurs, G-U-R-S, down in the south of France, near the Pyrenees. So when you read something like that, you think, hang on, you know, something's going on here. So I had to dig in a bit further. And that's when I became aware of a phase of the Holocaust, of the final solution to the Jewish situation, called the Madagascar Plan. Now, I may have heard that in the past, but I didn't take anything from it. So I began to read more about the Madagascar Plan, and that actually was one of the phases in this period to transport 4 million Jewish people from Europe to the island of Madagascar. And so when I read that, I thought, well, that doesn't fit into what I always thought. I always thought that when the Nazis came to power, their objective was to murder Jewish people, but it actually wasn't the case. Their objective was to rid Europe of Jewish people, but it wasn't actually to murder them. That came in more systematic from 1941 onwards. So I worked out 7 phases, okay? Anybody else who does research can have their own research models, but this is what helped me. And so phase one was a period up until 1933. What actually made up the Nazi worldview? What went into making up the attitude of the Nazis and Hitler towards the negative attitude towards the Jewish people? Yes, it was Hitler's own fantasies and his own life history, There were the attitudes of other Nazi leaders who were very much into the occult. There was the influence of imperialism, German imperialism, the thing of what happened after the First World War. Why did we lose the First World War? It's because the Jews back in Germany stabbed us in the back, and it's a total myth. And there was the role of Christian anti-Semitism in the historic churches. There was neo-Darwinism, okay, the influence of the eugenics and all that sort of stuff. There's a whole range of different things that made up this Nazi worldview. And it wasn't just one or two factors. But whatever, there is a worldview which said, basically, we don't want Jewish people in Germany. And so that was there when the Nazis took power on the 30th of January, 1933. That was their attitude towards the Jewish people. We want Germany to be Judenfrei, Jew-free. So then you get to 1933 onwards, and then there was the implementation of that worldview. And it was through intimidation, intimidating Jewish people, exploiting them with the hope that they would migrate, leave Germany. And tens of thousands did. Many didn't, but tens of thousands did. And we have to say, well, thankfully, they did. And many of those went to the land of Israel. So we are thankful that many people did leave. So therefore, they survived. So that's phase two. And there were killings of Jewish people, especially at Kristallnacht, and there was lots of physical intimidation, but there was no overall policy at this stage to murder collectively Jewish people. Then 1939, when the war began, the Germans go in, they take over Poland. Now they have almost another 3 million Jewish people under their control, as well as those in Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia. What to do with them? And so the plan then was to put them into a big area in Poland around the city of Lublin. And it was going to be a big ghetto. And it's going to be called Little Judea or something like that. And the interim stage would be to take Jewish people to bigger cities and the ghettos and then move them over to this larger region. Well, that didn't get fully implemented. So a lot of those Jewish people remained in the ghettos, Łódź, Krakow, Warsaw, and other places as well. So that was what was going on. Then when the war began in the West, okay, when they invaded the Netherlands and Belgium and France on the 10th of May 1940 and ultimately defeated those three countries, now they actually have another 550,000 Jewish people under their jurisdiction. What are we going to do with them? Move them all over to that little region of Poland? Well, that was logistically, that was quite a big issue. And so there, for decades in the past, there'd been this idea of taking the Jewish people out of Europe and putting them on an island somewhere away from Europe. And one of the islands that had been proposed was Madagascar off the east coast of Africa. So that plan was brought up again, and it was then adopted by the foreign ministry and by the SS, by the Nazis. And so they began to work on this plan, and it was a serious plan. And they were going to transport all 4 million Jewish people under their jurisdiction down to this island of Madagascar, and it would be an SS colony, basically. Wouldn't be a holiday camp. But to do that, after they had defeated France, they actually had to then defeat the island of shopkeepers, which is what Hitler referred to Britain as, because Britain ruled the waves, controlled the sea lanes. So they couldn't implement that plan until they had defeated Britain. So the plan was there. It was all worked out. There was a man called Adolf Eichmann who worked it all out. Okay, you can actually, it's there and in print how they intended to do it. But while Britain wasn't defeated, it couldn't be implemented. However, what they did was begin to move Jewish people from the western part of Germany down to the southern part of France in preparation to this place called Gurs. And so one particular time when I was doing that speaking tour in France, and we had to go down to actually, I needed to see that place. I needed to see it existed because it just didn't fit into any of my understanding of the Holocaust. So I had to see it, and it's true. It's there. And there are tombstones of Jewish people who died there, because later, after a year and a half or so, the Madagascar plan couldn't be implemented. They were sent all the way back up to first to Drancy near Paris and then over to the death camps. So the next phase in the Nazi solution to the Jewish problem was when they went into the Soviet Union. And there they were given license, the army was given license, and the death squads, the Einsatzgruppen, would give license to shoot Jewish men of a certain age because their crazy idea was Bolshevism and the Jewish people were synonymous. And so if they're a Jewish men, they are conduits of Bolshevism. They wanted to get rid of Bolshevism. So kill Jewish men of a certain age. It was called the Commissar's Order, where they were also told they could actually shoot Soviet officers. A lot of the German high command didn't like this, but nevertheless, it was to be implemented. It was an order from on high. And so then you have the systematic shooting now of Jewish men, innocent men, not in the army, not officers in the army, but because of their crazy way of thinking, these people were to be shot. So there were specialized murder squads called Einsatzgruppen, or Einsatzgruppen. Then on the 31st of July 1941, there was a particular letter that went from Hermann Göring over to Heydrich, who was the commander of this the thing with the Jewish people, the killing of the Jewish people and the status of the Jewish people. And as a result of that letter, I won't go into the details of the letter, but it gave him more authority, basically, to deal with the Jewish problem, the Jewish situation. In a very, very short period of time, those death squads who were writing down how many people they were shooting every day, they suddenly began to send in reports with women and children. So something was transpiring in that period of time, the beginning of August. Now, women and children were being systematically shot in the forests of Belarus and Ukraine. And it needs to be stated that not all of the executioners were actually Germans. Not all of those who were actually involved involuntarily or voluntarily, were Germans. There were actually many locals as well, Ukrainians, Lithuanians, Belarusians, etc., etc. So obviously something was now happening because now there were women and children also being systematically shot. So we've now morphed into a new phase. And then, so we're talking about thousands of people. At the end of September 1941, I think it was 34,000, between 29,000 to 34,000 Jewish people were shot over 2 days near Kiev, a place called Babi Yar. So this, we're now coming into a completely different dynamic. And then some people from Germany began to be transported from Germany, Jewish people from Germany over to these regions and were also being shot as well. At that particular stage, the senior leadership of the Nazis realized that the shooting of these people was not good for the mental health of the executioners. Man, that really gets me. They weren't interested in the people they were murdering. They're interested, concerned about the mental health of the executions. So they had to find another easier way, you might say, of killing Jewish people, of murdering Jewish people. And so that's when the whole idea of gas vans began to be implemented. And from that, gas chambers. It all grew out of the same thing. So now we're actually morphing to another phase, basically, the systematic murder on a mechanical style system. But then we get to the last phase, which is the conference in a place called Wannsee Haus near Berlin on the 20th of January 1942. And this was organized by the SS, but representatives of all the departments and the German government were also invited, and they were all told, this is our plan. Our plan is to rid Europe of the Jewish problem. We are going to murder 11 million Jewish people. We hear of 6 million. They succeeded in murdering 6 million. But the plan was to murder 11 million Jewish people. And this is how we're going to do it. Okay. Minister of Transport, this is your role. Foreign Ministry, that's your role. Economics Ministry, that's your role. And so on and so forth. And some didn't agree. By the end of the meeting, they all agreed. They were manipulated. So it was going to be a collective involvement of all the mechanisms of government. So from the time that decision was made, there was no hope for any Jewish person in Europe and the wider area, which meant North Africa, the Middle East, Turkey, all those countries were involved, and Britain were involved in that collective agenda to murder the 11 million Jewish people. So once that decision was made and it was signed and sealed, it's got the tick from the highest command of German and Nazi authority, there's no escape for any Jewish person in Europe. That's That's it. But then there was the implementation of the plan. And I won't go into the details about that. Are you depressed by now? Are you? Yeah. If you're not, you should be, basically. That's a depressing story I have just told. Okay. But there's always got to be a bit of light. In all of those dark situations, there was always a little light. And you don't need much light in a dark room to notice there is light. And so if there's anything redemptive from this research, anything that has sort of kept me going, and I've had a few meltdowns, I will confess, it's the realization that there's often, if not always, a little bit of light, a testimony. And so our task, in a sense, has been to try to find these testimonies of light, of people who survived or people who actually were a good witness and testimony in the midst of that darkness, those dark situations. And I've in the Dutch situation, my wife is Dutch, okay, and her own family members were involved at senior levels in opposing Nazi rule. One was a professor of law, lost his life in a German camp. Another one, like my wife's grandfather, was spent some time in Buchenwald concentration camp, for instance. And even when they were released, they still continued as best they could in the positions they had to oppose Nazi rule. And we all know of Corrie ten Boom and many of the other righteous amongst the Gentiles. And these people are absolutely incredible. But one person I've focused in upon was this guy called Johannes Rottenberg. He was Jewish, but he was also a pastor. And he was a pastor who opposed the Nazi presence and their worldview being implemented in the Netherlands. So the Germans, the Nazis actually used to send spies, people into the congregations to listen to the sermons. And they would have realized already the problematic ministers. And so they'd go to his church. And if he said anything that was inappropriate, well, that's an excuse to arrest him. And so he was ultimately arrested in January 1942 at about the same time as the Wannsee Conference, actually, but in a sense, not related, because implementation of the decisions at the Wannsee Conference never happened until the 15th of July in the Netherlands. So as it worked out, he was arrested because of his seditious preaching. The fact that he was Jewish didn't help matters. There was another reformed minister who was Jewish, completely 100% Jewish, a guy called Joseph Cohen, and his story is quite similar. But with Reverend Rottenberg, he was taken first of all to the prison near Scheveningen, which is near The Hague. And then he was transferred then to Amersfoort concentration camp. And in those in the Netherlands, there were several concentration camps and one transit camp called Westerbork, where they were all sent. And then from there, they were sent to Auschwitz or to Sobibor death camps. And so he went there. And of course, there's to be no religious services, nothing religious in the Nazi-led camps. Well, what do you think Reverend Rottenberg did? Okay, not allowed to bear witness, not allowed to have services. What's he going to do? He holds services. Okay, so who knows how many other people's lives were touched and affected by his preaching and his witness for the light. But that's a no-no. Okay, so he got caught and he had to do extra special treatment, which means he was beaten up and other things. So he was an academic man. He wasn't used to hard physical labor. So you can just imagine it would have worn him down. He was then sent to Buchenwald concentration camp, where there's a testimony that he did the same there. He actually held some services. And I have no doubt at all that he gave the good testimony. And then he was ultimately sent from there to a place called Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria. And this was a labor camp. It's a slave labor camp. Very few who went there survived because they were worked to death, doing all different sorts of terrible things. And so he survived there for 2 weeks and then he died. And there was a testimony that I found from after the war. Somebody had testified that he led at least one or two Jewish people to a saving knowledge of Jesus the Messiah in the time he was there. In 1944, his wife, Cornelia Rottenberg, received a letter from somebody who had been with him in Amersfoort. And this person just stated that he endured terrible conditions, but he was always a light in that dark place. And it was his son that I managed to track down in San Diego. So in a sense, we brought him all the way around. And that's just one of testimony of many others. There's another gentleman called Ernest Casuto, who later went on to be a messianic pastor in the United States. He was a totally secular Jewish person. He might have occasionally gone to synagogue, but he didn't know much about Jewish life until after the Nazis took control over his country and said to him, you can't go to the beach anymore. Why not? You're Jewish. You can't go to the restaurant anymore. Why not? You're Jewish. So he realized he'd better find out what it means to be Jewish. And he had a fiance called Hetty as well. And during the war, he actually, he was given a Bible by his mother. So because he said, listen, I better know what it means to be Jewish. So the mother gave him the family Tanakh, the scriptures. And then in the same period of time, providentially, he came into contact with a young man who was the son of a minister, a Dutch Reform minister. And through that contact, he went to a meeting that was being led by Johannes Rottenberg. And Johannes Rottenberg challenged this man about reading Isaiah 53. Okay. And he did. And sometime later, he on his own volition and his fiancée both committed their lives to being followers of Jesus as the Messiah in the midst of the war. Ultimately, though, when he got the deportation order, he knew that because the deportation order didn't say you've been sent to your death in Auschwitz. The deportation orders were you're being sent to Germany for labor. Okay. And so that's what people had the impression of. That's what they were doing. Well, nobody really wanted to go from their home to Germany for labor because they didn't know. Some knew, but collectively they didn't know. Or if they heard of it, they couldn't conceive that a country like Germany would send people to gas chambers. No. So they didn't believe it. But he was informed, go underground, dive under, go underwater, go underground. And so he did. And so too did his fiancée. She got picked up, however, and was later sent to, I would presume, to Sobibor because she died in a place not far away. But he survived. It was very difficult for him in that confinement. He ultimately was arrested, and it's quite a miracle how he survived. Quite a wonderful story, actually. He, too, he was in Rotterdam prison, and there was a Star of David on his prison cell, which meant he's Jewish. He's only here for a while till he gets sent further afield, to the east, is what they would say. But one morning he woke up and somebody had taken the Star of David away from outside of his cell block, and that's what saved him. And that's a bit of a miracle. And he then also began to hold services. Now, most of the other people that were there by this stage were not Jewish. Most of the Jewish people had been sent off. He was possibly the last Jew in Rotterdam. And that's the name of his book that he wrote later, The Last Jew in Rotterdam. But he survived, but he had services. And he managed to survive the war. And later he met another young lady who had been a young teenager who had committed her life to being a follower of Jesus during the war, also from quite a miraculous situation. He later met her afterwards. Her name was Ellie Rodriguez, and they were married. And they had a daughter some stage after they were married, at least 9 months, you presume. And so what happened then is that when the daughter was born, they named her Hetty. And Hetty was the name of the fiance that had actually not survived and had been sent. So that's a testimony in the sense that Nazis tried to extinguish the Jewish people. They tried to extinguish the Hebrew Christian movement. You have to realize the Hebrew Christian movement of Europe was very strong in the period before the war. There were thousands and thousands. Exactly how many? We don't know. But many thousands of Jewish people who followed Jesus through their own conviction, and many more thousands who were regarded as non-Aryan Christians. Okay, the Hebrew Christian movement was quite strong. So the Nazis had tried to destroy the Jewish people and had just tried to destroy the Hebrew Christian movement, but they did not succeed. So after the war, you had the establishment of the State of Israel, 14th of May 1948, a testimony that Yuti shall come forth from the ashes. And I personally find from this little story of this couple coming together and the child being named Hetty, it's just like saying, well, you tried to snuff out our life, but you haven't succeeded. A beauty shall come forth from the ashes. And so Ernest Casuto went to the United States afterwards and also became a pastor. Many of the people who, others who survived, became pastors in different churches in different parts of the world, and many of them, like Jakob Jotsch, for instance, became leaders thereafter in the Hebrew Christian movement, which of course then became the Messianic Jewish Hebrew Christian movement in the 1970s and 80s, to show that, you know, collectively, not only had the Jewish people survived and flourished, okay, and the state of Israel was established, so too has the Messianic movement survived and is now flourishing. So there's light. Not much. There's a lot of darkness. But there's a bit of light. And I think that's a testimony. We want to give these people a voice, those Jewish followers of Jesus who perished in the Holocaust. We want, in a sense, to give them a voice. But there's also more to it, I think. It's also a testimony to us, because we don't know what's ahead of us. It's a testimony, a challenge to us, to me, to others, that in the midst of the darkness, we still have to allow our light to shine. And I think on that note, I should finish up. Thank you.